Well, good morning. My name is Bob Voiles, principal of Seven Oaks Company and a member of the steering committee for this real estate prayer breakfast. Before I go on with my introduction of Reggie Campbell, I want to thank Sam again for telling us about real life, the life that all of us have. I know my friend Fred Henritzy said, you know, at one point with six children of his, that there's the life we live at work, and then there's the real life we live. And Sam just gave us a glimpse into his life and how the Lord has touched his life. So today, I have a big task. I get to introduce our keynote speaker, Reggie Campbell. So I want to remind everyone right now to take your iPhones and your Droids and just put them down on the table, face down, because we're going to just strap on your seatbelts, because we're going to have a great, great time together. When one asks, how does the world measure a person's greatness? How does the world keep score? The world keeps score through someone's fame, celebrity, balance sheet, political power, in some cases athletic prowess, or physical beauty. Certainly, the world uses that. And even as a Christ follower, I often look at things that way. You see, at one point early in his career, Reggie had all those things that the world desires. He had corporate recognition, exceptional financial success, a beautiful family, positions of respect and authority in his community. He was a hotshot young executive with AT&T, followed up by really a legendary career in the world of entrepreneurial startups. Reggie was a whiz kid in the world of high tech. But like many who ascend too quickly, Reggie ignored many warning lights that were blinking on his instrument panel, even as they turned from flashing yellow to bright red. And when incoming fire came in the form of major trials and the struggles of life, Reggie realized almost too late that his priorities had been misplaced. But here's the good news. Out of his deep love for Reggie, God allowed him to walk down some very dark paths. But in each case, he always met him there. God gave Reggie a new heart. He saved his family. He saved his marriage. He saved his life and picked him up and gave him an even greater purpose for living. Today, Reggie is one of my heroes. Much like Caleb and Samuel in the Old Testament, men who followed the Lord through the ups and downs of life, even up to the end. Reggie has stayed true to God's calling. Men like Chuck Colson, who God used prison to reform from a hard-edged, ruthless corporate lawyer and political operative into a tireless advocate of prison and Christian reformation. Or like my friend Bob Marsh, who, hitting a major speed bump at his church later in his career, at a time when most men would contemplate retirement, found an entirely new calling and vocation ministering to the evangelical communities across Europe. His voice and influence have only grown more powerful over time. Or like my friend Chris Ferguson, who is here with us today, who a decade ago returned to a very unstable land in Africa, his birthplace, Zimbabwe, and along with his wife, Norma, have invested a decade of their lives in the impoverished rural community and has become a beacon of light and hope, pointing the way to Jesus for so many of their neighbors. Reggie reminds me of these fine men. Like Samuel, like Caleb, Chuck, Bob, and Chris, Reggie has walked the talk. He has used his resources, influence, and immense talent to help expand the kingdom in furtherance of Jesus' great commission to the body of believers who make up his church. One of Reggie's capstone works has been establishing the ministry now called Radical Mentoring, which is now being used by churches, small groups, and discipling organizations literally across the United States and around the globe as a way to teach, train, and mentor young men. And today, right now, it's reaching tens of thousands to be better husbands, better fathers, better leaders, and more purposeful followers of Jesus. And I know the Lord is no doubt smiling. I've had the pleasure of participating in this mentoring process and leading others through it. It may be the most significant thing I've done over the last decade. Thank you, Reggie. Of everyone here, I'm probably the most excited about hearing what the Lord has laid on Reggie's heart for us today. So without further words, I want to introduce my good friend, mentor, and fellow Christ follower, Reggie Campbell.
After all that, I want to know who this guy is. Can somebody go out there and bring him in? Because that sounds so... Thank you, Bob. As you'll hear from my story, that's all about God. That's not about me. I want to tell you this. I may get emotional, and I'll just go ahead and apologize for that now. Because, one, my default setting is gratitude after all that God has done in my life. Two, I had a lung transplant 17 months ago, and I take 11 pills a day to keep Larry happy. But those meds seem to make me more emotional. I asked my transplant doctor if I might have gotten a woman's lung. And after telling him that I'd named him Larry, he said, "What if it was Hillary?" I'm not going to tell you what I said. I was told that this room would be full of hard charger, heat seeker kind of people. And I said, "That's great. That's right up my alley, because I am a hard charging, heat seeking kind of guy." And I don't know that I'm proud of that, but I found it out when I was sent to AT&T Information Systems Assessment in Secaucus, New Jersey. And this psychiatrist said, "Sir, you have scored higher on this achievement motivation test than anybody I've ever tested." And I said, "Wow, where do you think that came from?" He said, "You had a very, very, very highly unsatisfied need for affirmation as a child." I was like, immediately I knew what he was talking about. My dad, I didn't matter. I was the third child. I was 7 years after my brother, 11 years after my sister. They were both valedictorians, president of the student body in high school, straight A students. I came along 7 years later. My dad was 39 when I was born, and I wanted to matter. He ran out of energy to do sports he never did sports, but hunt and fish, do boy things. He never did any of those things with me. He was just tired, and I was hyperactive. And so I just couldn't get his attention. I couldn't get his affirmation except for doing one thing, and that was making money. He would come home from work, and if I had four A's and a B, he would say, "Why'd you make that B?" But if he came home and I'd cut four lawns and made $12, he would say, "Man, that is fantastic. That is great." And so I was early on, I figured out that I could matter to my dad by being successful and making money. But there was this deep-seated dissatisfaction inside of me that I want to matter. And so as a kid, it was like, I'm going to be the class clown. I'm going to do anything for a laugh. And the stories are legendary. My wife taught at the high school that I went to. And so she goes in the teacher's lounge and she starts hearing these Reggie stories about teacher walking to the door of her classroom, and I am going down the hall on my chest. I've run as hard as I could and dove, and I have my arms out and I'm saying, "Birdman." And she's like, "Oh my gosh, this is my husband." But it was anything for a laugh. And then when I and my dad used cars, is really the object lesson for everything I learned growing up was a car. Because I wanted a car because it was freedom. And I knew that making money made him proud. And so I had a car when I was 14 in South Carolina. And I drove to school in middle school. And I was turned loose as a kid. I grew up in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I went to Myrtle Beach for 4 days, unchaperoned at 14, driving my own car. My sister said, "They just trusted you because you were such a good boy." I said, "They wanted to get rid of me for 4 days so they could get some rest." It was just crazy, the freedom that I was given. So as an adolescent, I started trying to matter by being cool. So a couple years later, I bought myself a 66 GTO. And I dated every girl in school once. It just didn't work out. And never forget, in 10th grade, my guidance counselor called me in and she said, "Well, Reggie, you're really having a good time, but do you realize you're on a course to be the only black sheep in the Campbell family? Because you're not going to get in college with the grades you have." And so that scared me. Again, going back to not mattering, and I certainly didn't want to be the black sheep. So I started studying a little bit harder, got into school. And the first day of college, a regional campus of the University of South Carolina, I walk into this thing that they're doing for freshman activities, and there is this girl that is in a cheerleader uniform that has the best legs I have ever seen in my life. And today, at 67, she still has the best legs of any woman I've ever seen. Now you see why she doesn't want to come when I speak. I was immediately just smitten, and it took me 6 months to get up the nerve to ask her out, and she said yes. And 6 months later, we were married. And all of a sudden, I became a good student. I was flunking out until I met her. But she was a Christian, and she meant it. I was a Christian too. Because I'd walked down the aisle of the Baptist church when I was 12, and I'd professed that I believed in Jesus, and I did. Never stopped believing in Jesus. I was baptized. And so when she says Christian, I'm like, "Yeah, I'm Christian." And I just turned up the volume. I turned down the volume of the rock and roll drummer, because I was playing drums in a rock and roll band. And I turned up the volume of Christian. So I just cranked up the religious talk and took her to church things and so forth. And I completely faked her out. And so we got married. And then we got through college together. And then I went to work with AT&T Information, well, AT&T at the time. And all of a sudden, like an addict who has finally found his drug of choice, I found success. That was what I was looking for. That scratched all the itches, because now I could matter, because I could be successful. I got lots of attention. I got all this affirmation. I'd get a promotion. I didn't call my wife first. I called my dad. He was who I was trying to please. We went to church every Sunday. In the environment of a large corporation, there's usually lots of social drinking. And I'd been a teetotaler all the way through high school. Learned to drink a little bit in college, but man, when I hit the corporate world, all those cocktail parties and free booze, and I started tasting a little bit of this one and tasting a little bit of that one, and all of a sudden I was having something to drink regularly, and it didn't seem to matter. I just kept doing that, and I got more into career, and they started moving us around. So they moved me from Columbia to Spartanburg to Greenville. Both of our children were born in Greenville, South Carolina. Then they moved me to Atlanta. And all along the way, I kept telling Miriam, "We're going to be fine. 5 years from now, I'm supposed to be either fired or a district level, and then we'll get off this bus and we'll put down roots and we'll stay in that one place. Well, after all these years of moving around and me working so hard, and she was focused on the house and the kids, we started not being quite so close. And I got a little judgmental of her, and she didn't put her hand on my knee when we would be in a movie, and she didn't this, and she didn't that. And she was looking at me, and it's like, man, he's not exactly that Christian guy that I thought I married. And he's with us, but he's not, his heart's not here. He's not really connecting with me. He's not appreciating anything I'm doing at home or with the kids. And so just little by little, we're just kind of going apart. And every time I'm getting more promotions and I'm getting more money and we're buying a nicer house and we move to Atlanta. And then when the Bell system broke up and AT&T split, I went with AT&T Information Systems, and they offered me the dream job, not just district level, but division level. I would be the youngest division level in the company, and they would move me to Charlotte, North Carolina. That was 45 minutes from her mother's house, an hour from my parents, 30 minutes from my sister, 2 hours from the mountains, 3 hours from the beach, and no traffic. And it was, you know, Charlotte demographically is about 20 years behind Atlanta, and it's just now beginning to get some of the horrible traffic problems that we've all experienced for quite a while. We move there to an apartment. My wife designs a house. We build it. We move in. I'm knocking it out of the park. Work-wise, I'm getting all these accolades. I'm managing a division that's nationwide just for one industry. I've hired 45 people in 6 months. It's all going great, and we just don't like each other. I'm coming home late. I smell like booze all the time, and it's just not going well at all. Out of the blue, my mentor, who's here in Atlanta, the regional VP, sends his emissary up to Charlotte. And he says, Glenn wants you to move back to Atlanta. Now understand, we've just built this house that my wife designed, and we've been in it less than 2 years. And you know what I said? Okay, I'll take it. He said, don't you want to speak to your wife? I said, nah, she'll come. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the square root of stupid. There are still claw marks down I-85 from the back of the moving truck. We were in real trouble. I was in real trouble, what much worse than I thought. We were here 30 days. I took a huge cut in pay. I went from having 106 employees to nobody but me. Poked around, found a marriage counselor. I said, we're gonna go to a marriage counselor. She would never go to counseling with me, and I'd never been to counseling either, but I was convinced I could find a counselor who could fix her. Sidebar. Gentlemen, if you want to get your wife fixed, don't take her to a female counselor. This lady saw through me like a plate glass window, and I knew it. She scheduled a date for us the following Saturday night. And she, Miriam dressed up, she looked so good, and I hadn't talked to her in months. I mean, we just really were on such different wavelengths. And we had the first real conversation we'd had in a long, long time. And all of a sudden, she was asking me questions that she had never asked. And I loved her too much to lie for the first time in my life. And we had a real, honest conversation. And she said, you know, Reggie, we have different dreams. She got in the car. We got home, she got in the car and left. And I was like, wow. I never even thought, never contemplated that that could happen. And she just went and drove around for a while. She came back, and then the next morning, she had her suitcase packed. And she said, I'm leaving. I gotta figure out what I'm gonna do with the rest of my life. She just left the kids. She said, I'm going to leave you with the kids. You get to know them while I'm gone. Best thing she ever did. It was absolutely what I needed. That night, after I got the kids to bed, I walked out in the backyard of my house, and I looked up at the sky in this beautiful September sky, and I broke down, and I said, Lord, I don't know who I am either. I don't know who I am. I've messed up my life. I mean, the things that I most valued and treasured years ago, that I was so amazed that this girl would marry me, she's gone, and I've killed our relationship. Will you take me? Will you forgive me for all that? I've been reading. I know the gospel. I know that you will, but I'm just doing that now. I want you to be my God and not just my Savior. I want you to be my Lord. And I said these words, and they were prophetic words. I said, from this point forward, God, it's you and me. It's me and you, God. Because I honestly thought the next time I saw her, she'd be sitting in a Ryder truck with her brother, coming to pick up her stuff and her kids and go back to South Carolina where she grew up. And I could see myself sitting in a one-bedroom apartment. Many of you have been there. With a television and an empty checkbook, spending every dollar I had to support my wife and kids living in another state. That's what I could see. And so I surrendered everything to him. I said, I'm just going to be your man. I don't care what anybody thinks. You're all I got. You know, Jesus won't be all you need until he's all you have. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I do have my career, but all the money's going to go to her. So I don't have anything. So I surrendered to him. A week later, she calls, and she's gone back to Charlotte. And she stayed with our pastor, which is an out-of-body experience for her. She's very private. But she said, how are the kids? She didn't ask about me. And I told her that they were doing fine. I said, but let me tell you what I did. I surrendered my life to Jesus Christ. And I've had the best week I've ever lived. I have completely peace in my heart like I've never had. Me and the kids are closer than we've ever been. I've got them making their own beds, which was a miracle. And she said, well, you know, those are different words than I've ever heard come out of your mouth. But your voice still sounds the same. But I'm going to come home and check it out. And 6 hours later, she drove up. And she stayed that night. And the next day I said, will you stay one more day? I think you'll see over time that maybe God's doing something and I'm going to be a different kind of guy. She said, okay, I'll stay one more day. The next day I asked if she'd stay another day. That's been 33 years. And I'm still on a day-to-day contract. I'm negotiating for a weekly deal. That's not going well. It's an old AT&T adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's where she stands. But folks, there was a tension that I didn't realize. Maybe it's a tension that you feel. I don't know. But for years and years, I rested in this complacent sense of security that I was a Christian, that if I died, I would go to heaven. But I really wasn't sure. And I would hear preachers, you know, I'd see the guy in the end zone at the football game in John 3:16, and I knew, you know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that if you believe in him, you receive eternal life. I believe that. I never stopped believing that. But then there are these other verses that just freak me out. There's this one that says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I was 33 years old. I'd never heard his voice. I never followed him. I never tried to do what he said to do. I mean, I knew the Ten Commandments. I think I may have not killed anybody, but the others were run right by most of the time. But to hear his voice was such a foreign thing to me. And it was like, I may not be a sheep. I may not be one of his sheep. He may not know me. And then to make it worse, there's another one. And these are all, by the way, in your Bible, they're red letters. And that means they're spoken by him, by the only person ever to die and come back to life. You can go to any major religion in the world, the founder never claimed to live and die. Jesus came back to life, was seen by 500 people. I listen. I read those red words extra special. But he said this, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father. Oh, you mean I have to do something? Yeah, I think so. I think if it's real, if Jesus is real, you got to do something. You got to follow him. He's got to mean something to you. And I've thought about, you know, what happened that night and what I did differently after that night. And I really sort of came down to three things. One was I started to look at people the way he looks at them. I realized that I'm a son, but you're a son, and you're a daughter. And my wife is a daughter, and I have no right to judge her or tell her how she should be or criticize her for not being this way or that way. Because God looks at me and loves me and accepts me. Who am I to not love and accept somebody else? And that changed my whole way of relating to people. Before, it was, what can I get out of you? It was, use people to get things. And he just changed my whole value system about that. I started to trust God with the outcomes of things. Up until that night, I could talk my way into or out of anything I wanted. I could always manage it, manipulate it. I could get there, set a vision, set a goal, get people to follow me. I could get stuff done. But there was absolutely no way I could make my wife love me again. There's no way I could make her come back home and be the mother to my children with me in the same house. I was powerless. And when I surrendered to him, that's what I said. I said, this is up to you. It's you and me, God. Because you got to be with me. You got to help me through this regardless of what happens. It's you and me. If she comes back, it's you and me. If she doesn't come back, it's you and me. And then the third thing that really defined my life from that point, well, I was just so grateful. I have had and still have this incredible sense of gratitude that he loves me. You know, I've probably reconstructed that night 1,000 times. I've tried to figure out what happened. Why did... She said when she came back, she said, you weren't dancing anymore. You'd always vibrated. You know, your leg was like this. You were always thinking about what people thought. You're always trying to be funny, always trying to be smart, all that. She said, all that was gone. You were peaceful in your own skin for the first time. And it wasn't like some self-improvement program that happened over a month, a year, or 2 years. It was instant. And I figured out what happened. I figured out God loved me. He loved me. He was the perfect father I never had. He loves you too. Everybody in here's got daddy issues. Every one of us. I've mentored 128 guys now intentionally for a year at a time. And I've yet to meet a guy that didn't have daddy issues. And for you ladies, you know, to one degree or another, did your dad really tell you you were lovely and lovable? Did you get everything you needed from him? If you did, God bless you. You are such a unique, blessed woman. But for us guys, Sam's story, my story. I would help my dad wash the car. The only time I could get his attention one-on-one during the whole week was to wash the car on Saturday morning. I'll never forget one morning, I dropped the rag. I'm like 7. I drop the rag, I pick it up, and I go back to washing the car. He comes over and he grabs the rag out of my hand, and he said, you can't do that, you'll scratch the paint. You can't do anything right. He didn't mean to hurt me. It's what I had. But you know what? That night in September, my Heavenly Father showed me he loved me. He came in and he said, I love you, Reggie. And that changed everything in my life. I never, since that time, have ever felt alone. Move the clock forward a few years. My son is in school. He's on his way back on Saturday afternoon. We're going to watch the Georgia-Tennessee game. I get a call about 3:30 in the afternoon, and it's a gruff voice. And it says, sir... I think it's your son. He's been involved in a pretty serious accident. He's being airlifted to Grady Hospital. You probably need to drive down there. He said, I found his cell phone. It's broken, but the last number he dialed says, Dad, I assume that's you. It's a green Pathfinder. I said, "Officer, is he alive?" He said, "Sir, I'm a highway patrolman, not a doctor. I would just suggest you get to Grady Hospital." I got to Grady Hospital in record time. Called my wife, who was getting her hair done. My daughter was with her. I said, "Don't tell your mom what's going on. Just get her to Grady Hospital." Parked the car, and I was walking around the corner of Grady Hospital. I stopped, and I looked up at that bright blue September sky, and I said, "It's you and me, God." I knew I was going to be okay. I knew my son was going to be okay. He's a Jesus follower. Was and still is. Serious Jesus follower. But I just didn't know how I was going to help my wife get through losing a son. Not at 25. Not her firstborn. Not one that's so unique and special that just has her heart in his hand. 20 minutes later, she arrived. We met a young intern who I hope I never run into, who told us that they were minutes away from doing a lobotomy to relieve the pressure. She had no idea what she was talking about. She shouldn't have been talking to us because it wasn't true. The lobotomy was going to be the next day, but still, it was just this, it just shook us so badly. And then we started to pray. And the people at Grady were so embarrassed because these people were out blowing snot bubbles in the hall. So they put us in the little room where they put you to wait until they come and tell you that your loved one is gone. And we sat in that room and we prayed. And then people started to come and people started to come. And by that night, there were 40, 50 people all in the ICU praying for my son all night long. The next day spread to churches all around Atlanta, and there were tons of churches. I mean, the whole church is praying on Sunday morning. Even a secret church prayed for my son. At 12:45, the head of neurosurgery from Emory came out and said, wouldn't talk to me. I always talk to the mom. "Mrs. Campbell, the brain bleed in your son's head has stopped growing. We can't explain it. We were just about to do lobotomy to relieve the pressure in his head. But I think he might be okay." The next day, they moved him to a regular room. A week later, to Shepherd Head Injury Center. A month later, he's back in school. And today, he's a dermatologist with two little boys and a happy marriage. And the only thing we know is that he can't ever find his keys. My good deed of surrendering to Jesus was rewarded in the workplace by my mentor being forced to retire. And I decided wisely 6 months later I needed to leave AT&T. I ended up starting a little business, and that led to another business. And I got involved in a church in a meaningful endeavor to try to follow Jesus and to learn about him and what life would look like following him. And I just been, it's been a course of learning and study and relationship and community ever since then. And a few years ago, working with singles at a church here, someone started calling me their mentor. And I looked at all the time I'd spent with them, and I couldn't see a whole lot of progress. I said, I got to be more intentional about this. So I invited eight of them into a program that I made up to come to my house once a month. And we'd read a book together, and we'd memorize a little scripture, and we'd just do life, and we'd sign confidentiality. I'd tell them my whole story, and I did that again, and I did that again, and eventually, I mean, it's just taken off. It wasn't ever intended to be some ministry or something that would be anything other than eight guys around my dining room table, but it is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. You know, for all of you who are Jesus followers, I would even say this. As a Christian, you have the first part of John 10:10, where he says, "I have come that they might have life." If you're a Christian, if you believe in Jesus, I think you have life. But the rest of that verse says, "and have it to the full." And I don't think you can have life to the full until you become a Jesus follower. And if you look at what Jesus followers do, they do stuff. They do the will of the Father. You know, you hear a guy who's saying, "Man, I love my church. I love my small group. I have eternal life. I have How many times did you just say I? Jesus was all about other people. And when you start investing in other people and helping other people and doing things like this host committee, they don't get anything out of doing this. This is all for you, for us, to help us take a step towards being a Jesus follower. So I made that turn, and it's the best move I've ever made in my life. And I love Jesus, and what's more important is He loves me. He is the Father I never had, and He loves you. He didn't want anything from you. What could God possibly want from you? Does He want to, is He a buzz killer? Does He want to just ruin your life and take away all your fun? You know, I stopped drinking 34 years ago. I haven't missed a bit of it. Now, I'm not harping on drinking, but for me, it was depressive. It led me to really bad decisions. But the life I have now with Him, in Him, is such a different experience than what I had for those first 33 years. He didn't want anything from you. He wants something for you. He wants you to have the freedom, the clear conscience, the enjoyment of helping other people, of seeing other people grow in their faith, of what you get when you love and serve other people selflessly. And my wife would tell you, if she had the nerve to get up here and tell you, I am a different person. And it's not because I tried, not because I was born that way. It was because my Father in heaven showed me that He loved me. And I engaged with that. I loved Him back. You know, if you're worshiping your career or the project or the next building you're going to build, you know, Charlie Paparelli taught me this years ago. If you're going to love a God, you better pick one who's going to love you back. My AT&T career didn't love me back. None of my business endeavors ever loved me back. But my Father in heaven, He loved me first. He loves me now, and He loves me back. And if I could challenge you today, don't rock along thinking that you're safe and secure because you went through a confirmation class, or you prayed some prayer when you were 8 years old, or you were baptized when you were 12. Do you know Him? Do you hear His voice? Do you follow Him? That's where real life is. Thanks.